Blog Talk Radio.
Paranexus Universe. This is Doug Kelly, your host. It's Thursday, July 31st, 2008, last month of July, August. I'm here with Grant Ruben Dunst, co-host and friend. Hey, Grant.
Hey, Doug. How you doing? How's everybody this evening?
Good, man. So some good news on Mars, eh?
Oh, yeah. For those in the audience who might not have been listening to the major news networks tonight, there was an announcement, and NASA had a news conference today, to announce the fact that they have found water on, indeed have found water on Mars. The Tega experiment that I kind of was complaining about last week, the results have finally come in, and that's where they heated up the soil to, I guess, around 1,000 degrees, and sure enough, they found water. So, wow, that's quite a revelation because, you know, the scientists weren't really sure if the ice was composed of carbon dioxide or water, and now we're pretty sure. So, makes you wonder and scratch your head if there's thermal vents on Mars someplace, eh?
Yeah, that's great. That's great news. Well, before we get into our show tonight, I'd just like to take a moment and if we could just lower our heads a little bit and say a small prayer. Almighty Skype gods, we come before you and we beseech you and praise you and we beg for your mercy and kindness tonight that you don't cut us off and drop our calls. We would really appreciate that. And we're always looking up to you and trying to surround you with our life and just hoping and praying that you don't drop our freaking calls. In yours, and yours name, amen. Thank you very much. Okay. Do you think that appeased the Skype gods tonight, Grant?
Hallelujah.
Yeah, we'll see. All right. Tonight, we have Dr. PMH Atwater back with us. She was with us a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about near-death experiences. And tonight, we talk about Beyond the Indigo Children. Here's a little bit of a refresher on Dr. Atwater. She was born in Twin Falls, Idaho. She married young, became a mother of three, Sunday school teacher, secretary, and prize-winning cook. Handwriting analysis in the mid-1960s led to a complete career and lifestyle change. She was redirected into public service and innovative project development and analysis. Paralleling this change, she began intensive research into paranormal and altered states of consciousness. With a professional background in hypnotic past life regressions, sensitivity work, de-haunting houses, and mediumship, she came to specialize in aura, massage, astrology, numerology, dream and symbol interpretation, rune casting, divinatory, and earth energy sensing. Dr. Atwater, certainly nice to have you back with us again tonight.
Well, it's good to be here, but, you know, I'm listening to this resume, and I don't even relate to it. Isn't that odd?
Well, it actually goes on and on and on. I just don't have the time to read it.
Well, that was way back when. You know, that's before I died.
Well, three times in 1 year, right?
Yeah. 1977 is your turned everything around for me.
Yeah, I guess I didn't read that part. 1977 set the stage for severe health traumas resulting in death and the near-death phenomena three times in 3 months. That's right, three times in 3 months. So, wow.
Now, we call it I call it the heavenly sledgehammer effect.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So tell us about the Indigo Children. I know you've got some pretty passionate thoughts on this. But just to begin with, who exactly are the Indigo Children?
Well, I have to take a deep breath here and invite your audience to be sure and get my book, Beyond the Indigo Children, because let's get beyond these labels. Indigo is simply a label. It was a label that was concocted a number of years ago by a psychic medium, and confirmed by a woman who could see auras, that there was a new type of child coming into the earth plane that was unusually intelligent, very psychic and creative, that had an indigo aura. Did not have an aura then, like most other children, but was distinctive in the fact that the aura was the color of indigo. And the book about them became a bestseller, and the idea caught on. And then all of a sudden, a lot of psychics and mediums throughout the world began to confirm this with their sightings of children with indigo auras. Where this phenomenon has a lot of holes in it is because most of the new children that have the characteristics described by this so-called label do not have indigo auras. In fact, most of the children that were found that had them were in the state of California and in a few other places around the world, but most of the children don't, but yet they have all these characteristics. So what I did was I got busy and did a lot of looking, did a lot of study, did a lot of research, dug around a lot. And the reason I did so much digging is because in my work as a near-death researcher, I noticed that children who come back from death and the characteristics that they exhibit, the way they behave, seems to match or nearly so what is claimed by this so-called indigo phenomenon. So that meant that I did even more digging. The book that I talk about this, the first book that I talked about this, is called The New Children and Near-Death Experiences. And I think it's worthy to really look at children being born who do not have near-death experiences and growing up, and children who do have near-death experiences, and to compare them. And when you do, it's really quite an eye-opener. So that's why I just dug so heavily into this. And, you know, what I caution your listenership to remember is that labels limit. And what we've now found today is that these kinds of exaggerated labels that have been applied to today's children are causing more harm than good. And I would call your attention to these labels. Things like indigo, crystal, starseed, transition, cosmic, psychic. There's a number of others of them that are being used. If you take all of these labels and actually toss them, just toss them out the door, forget about them, but take a look at all the characteristics described by those, that the labels supposedly describe. If you take all those characteristics from all of those labels, bunch them together, and then you have the profile of the new children. In other words, most of the children being born today are like this. It's a worldwide phenomenon, and I truly believe that what we're seeing here is evolution in our time, that this fabled quantum leap that was going to occur in the human family or the human species has occurred. It's happening right now. If you're a parent of one of these kids, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
So how do you know that that's occurring right now? How do you know that this evolution?
Well,
species?
We know it from science. We know it from various observations. We know it from what's really happening. A lot of books being written now. Again, from observations and field work. Most of my work is field work and observational, but I also cross-check everything I have with what else might be going on in the field. And now today we have a lot of science behind us. In other words, when this first came up, there was not that much in the way of findings or science out there. Now today in 2008, there is. So what I would like to do, with your permission, is I'd like to start talking about the talents and assets these kids have. Then I'd also, later on, like to talk about their liabilities, their weaknesses, and the problems that they have.
Sounds good.
Does that sound okay?
That's great, Doctor, because that's what I was going to ask you. What characteristics do these children manifest?
Yeah, I must be psychic.
Me too.
All of us are.
Man, you're psychic, not psychic.
Well, these children are very, very, very intelligent. I don't care if they're flunking in school and can't spell. These are the most intelligent children we've ever produced. We have no other generation in recorded history that quite matches these kids. Let me talk a little bit about their intelligence before I move on to their other characteristics, because this is such a big one. About one-third of them are geniuses. Now let me sort of do a little catching up here with science before I move on. We know now through reports coming in and analysis being done, in those countries that use standard IQ tests, if we look at the results of testing, IQ testing, standard IQ tests, in those countries that apply it, that use it, there has been a sudden jump in scores between 24 to 26 points. Now, and all of a sudden, about one-third of the kids, and when I say all of a sudden, I mean just within a few years, we've got about one-third of the kids who take these tests that are scoring between 150 to 160 on these tests. And that, of course, is a high recording for genius. Now,
at what age are they? Are we testing them? Are you talking about the waist, Doctor?
Well, most of them have every school age by then.
Right.
So it depends.
Just out of curiosity, where is that data coming from? Is it coming from?
It's coming all over the world, from all of those countries that use these tests, from educators and from scientists. Now, some IQ tests can be applied to babies and children, very young children, even toddlers. But most IQ tests are applied later on in grade school, sometimes in junior high.
Right.
So those seem to be the main ages when kids are tested. Now, when you talk to educators, they'll say that scores between 134 to 136, that's assigned a genius. And another educator will jump right in and say, no, that's not true. They have
well,
to have
I think
a
what's
score
important
of at least
is our
140.
Audience understand, the audience needs to understand what the mean is on that. And the mean on that for the general population is 100. So when you're talking 120, 130, 150, 60, that's way up there. That's quite a few standard deviations above the norm.
Okay, but look at how many children are doing it. We've got one-third of all children being tested worldwide with this test, now scoring between 150 to 160 with no genetic markers to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a glitch in the scores. And the glitch in the scores is you can't trace the results back to education. You can't trace it back to better nutrition. You can't trace it back to better parenting. What it traces back to is what is called nonverbal intelligence, which is creative problem solving. In other words, we cannot explain this jump, nor can we explain the area of brain development and brain intelligence that this jump focuses on. In other words, it's just an incredibly surprising jump that still today no educator can explain. Well, I find the same thing with the kids that had near-death experiences. Didn't matter what they were like before, afterward they had this jump in intelligence. And about, well, in my study, it was almost a half of them came back geniuses. But it's just incredible what's happening. Now, if we stop for just a minute, Doug and Grant, and take a look at what science is telling us about genes. There was an article, maybe around the first of the year this year, that was talking about the two genes that build a better brain. And these genes have been around for a while, but all of a sudden, again, no explanation to why this jumped so quickly. They now estimate that 70% of the population in the world has at least one of them. So at least 70% are really intelligent now, or, you know, really close to that. And 30% of the world's population, they now estimate, has both of them. Now, this matches what we're seeing in IQ tests. It matches what I'm finding in my near-death research. These kids are unusually smart. They are very music-oriented. They're clever innovators and inventors. They're extremely creative. They're intuitive. They're psychic. Most of them can remember past lives. They're excellent with math. They're natural-born healers and entrepreneurs. They're almost completely irreverent. They are creative problem solvers. They're volunteer-minded. They just, you know, they race toward humanitarian projects. If there isn't one going, they'll start their own. They have strong spatial abilities. In fact, they're visual spatial learners. They're groupies. They abstract at very young ages. They are multisensory. They live in a multiverse. And they are multi-channelers. Now, one of the things I want to underscore here is their ability to abstract. And I think that's one of the reasons why we think they are so wise and say such wise things. I don't think it's wisdom. I think it's this ability to abstract. Let me say a little bit more about abstraction, then I want to give you a couple of examples. People who can abstract are dealing on the conceptual level. They deal with broad spans of knowledge. This very familiar phrase, you know, thinking outside the box. For these kids, they can't even recognize or see that a box was ever there to begin with. I mean, they're actually unlimited in their ability to think, to create, to dream, to imagine. They're not like most other people. They're just absolutely unlimited. And I would say that of all their talents, this is their greatest one. Now, let me give you two examples. Let me give you one example from near-death research.
Okay.
I had a boy in the first grade who drowned a little bit before Christmas, so about halfway through the school year. They were able to bring him back when he was finally able to get back to school and back to the first grade. Now we're talking first grade here. So the other kids, the curriculum is See, Spot, Run, Dick and Jane. So this boy gets back to his first grade class, same one he left, only now he's reading Greek mythology, and he goes up to his teacher and he says to her, why was the book Robinson Crusoe ever written?
Huh.
Now, that's abstraction. He's dealing on a conceptual level. They had to take him out of the first grade, put him in a special learners class. Here's a 2.5-year-old toddler, and she and her mother are talking, and the toddler gets very impatient. By the way, when we get into the weaknesses these kids have, they're very impatient. Well, she got very impatient. Her name is Michaela. And she went up to her mother, and she put her hands on her hips, and she looked her mother right in the eye, and she said, "Well, I don't know the word for that yet." Now, what 2.5-year-old knows they don't know the word for something?
That was pretty good.
When they're in conversation,
huh.
What 2.5-year-old knows that?
Well, it certainly makes you wonder about, you know, if we've ceased to evolve physically, what's the next step in our evolution going to be? It's going to have to be on the level and in the framework that you're talking about. So that's got to be a very exciting thing for people who are researching it in the field.
It's very exciting. It has its downside, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, but it is very exciting.
How are these kids socializing?
Excuse me?
How are these kids do as far as socializing?
Well, if they're on the computer and technology a lot, they have problems. If they don't, they do just fine. They do just fine among themselves, but not necessarily with other people. So let's look at the liabilities here. We can come back to some of the rest of it, but let's look at some of the liabilities or weaknesses. These are quick click kids. That means they're impatient. They want everything now. They are the ultimate consumers. They are short-term thinkers, not long-term. The idea of saving money or investing is absolutely foreign to them. They have to be taught that. There's an underlying anger in this generation of kids. It's one of their markers or signatures is this peculiar anger that they have. And I wouldn't call it the normal kinds of anger. What it seems to be is a real frustration with anything that's overly exaggerated or not genuine. They just don't seem to be able to handle that too well. You know, in your cartoons, for instance, you've got phrases now like rug rat rage, you know, talking about the little rug rats, these little kids even in diapers that have these anger fits.
Rug rat rage.
I mean, it's true. It's true throughout the entire generation. They prefer the astral and things like and synthetic worlds. You know, they thrive on things like Warcraft and all these different video games and Game Boys and this kind of stuff. And they attend night school. A lot of them attend night school. Now, I used to think that meant they were good dreamers, had very vivid dreams, and in their dreams, maybe there could be a certain continuity of, you know, the major things they were interested in. This is literal. And I didn't believe it was until one day I was in a mall, you know, a big shopping mall, and there was a woman to my right who had a little boy. Oh, gee, he might have been around 6. And then way down the hall, there was a mom and dad and their little boy, about the same age, I suspect. And the two boys started running toward each other, called each other by name, and they started talking about the assignments they were given the night before in night school because they went to the same night school. And they were just chattering like a couple of little monkeys. And so I went up to the parents, the mom and mom and dad, were just in a state of shock over this because the mom was local. The mom and dad and their little boy were tourists. They were just passing through town. There was no way these boys could have known each other's names or anything about a night school, yet they knew exactly what each other's assignments were, And they could describe and did describe the same school, the same teachers, and the same children who were in their class.
Okay, can I stop you for just a second?
Sure.
All right, so this night school, I mean, we're talking, I mean, at least I thought we were talking about an actual night school, but apparently this night school doesn't exist. Is that correct?
No, I think it does exist.
Where does
I think it
exist?
I think it exists on a different grid or matrix in the ethers.
Okay, so.
You know, if you know anything at all about shamanism, for instance, you know that shamans are trained through various initiations and through various teachers how to reach these certain frequencies of vibration wherein there are what they come to realize is a physical matrix or world or grid patterning where certain things happen. And these grids are identified, these matrices, grids, and you'll find that just about any other shaman in any other type of the world, if they reach that vibration, they'll describe basically the same type of world or realm or grid work. So I don't feel that this is make-believe.
Okay, well.
I think this is real.
Let me ask you this question because it seemed like a good time. Is there any correlation, relationship, or connection of these new children to the alien abduction phenomena?
Not really, although some people go out on a limb and say there is. But their claims do not hold up in broad-based research. So I'm going to have to be the person here that just sort of looks askance at this. What you do find and what I did find in my near-death research with children, and I write about it in the book, Beyond the Indigo Children, is that a lot of, let's just talk now about the near-death kids. A lot of the near-death kids do talk about what we would call aliens or extraterrestrials. Most of them, however, talk about themselves as once being particles of the universe, like a standing wave or an asteroid or part of a planet, who came here because they heard Earth, our planet, send out an SOS signal that it needed help for the changes. And so these children or these beings or these parts of our universe then began to take on form so that they could incarnate in the earth plane. And this storyline is really quite intricate. It is quite detailed with many of these children, and again across the world, not just in the United States. And some of the details that are given, for instance, Flavio Carbobianco, in, I believe it's Argentina, he wrote the book, I Came from the Sun. And in his book, he has chart after chart after chart he made when he was about 4 or 5 years old that are extremely detailed. And he describes these charts in his book using a kind of language that an adult would use when he was only like 4. So, you know, you're running into some very, challenging but fascinating work here.
So, Doctor, if I could just interrupt, when did this phenomena start, and how far along are these kids? How old would the oldest children be who were identified, and what kind of things are we seeing?
We haven't finished talking about the weaknesses, but let's go ahead and move over to that question because it's a good question. When you look at the pattern of what I prefer to call the new children, in other words, I'm tossing the labels. I'm just looking at the pattern of their characteristics. If you just look at that pattern, You can find traces of it back in the days of Jesus. So we're going back like 2,000 plus years. There wasn't that many then, but there were some. you find a lot of them during every renaissance the world has ever known. It's as if waves or clusters of them came in then. Then you started seeing another large movement in history in the 1800s, and especially about 1850 on to about 1921. And you know, a lot of these existentialists like Thoreau and Emerson, these were the new kids. The next big bunch that started coming in was the 1960s, 1970s, but none of these entries were nearly as large as what happened in 1982. And, you know, I can say the early 1980s, but I'm going to be more specific here, and I'm going to say 1982. And from that year on, the floodgates opened wide. They haven't closed. I don't think they're going to close, because I think these new kids are us. That's where we are headed as the human family.
It's fascinating. It really makes you wonder if we are evolving, you know, from that standpoint, which makes a lot more sense. And it's kind of comforting when you talk about two little boys like that from such different parts of the country and such different areas, and being able to instantly identify each other and, you know, embrace and be able to relate like that. And, boy, that's certainly something the human race could use. If only us adults could do that all the time,
yeah.
Right? It'd be a lot better.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Atwater, you had mentioned previously that some of these kids are multiverse. They exist.
Well, they live in a multiverse.
Can you explain that?
They don't live in a universe. They live in a multiverse. And in other words, they're very aware of parallel worlds and different kinds of worlds and different kinds of universes, different kinds of grids and matrices. Some of them even know how to make their own grids and matrices. They're very aware of the networking and the fabric of the universe and what that looks like, and how that can be handled, seen, interacted with. Participated with, even rewoven themselves in different ways. So these kids are living, well, first of all, let's recognize that these are children from the global village. It's the first generation in all history that is aware of the global family, and receive input from the global family. It's also the first generation in all of history to view the world through a screen. And that's very sobering. You know, we talk about the global family, and it's like, yeah, yeah, you know, Ray, Ray, we're finally getting into this idea that, you know, we're really all one family. But then you have to just sort of stop, take a few steps back and say, but they're the first children in history to view the entire world through a screen.
What exactly does that mean?
That never happened before.
What does it mean?
Well, that means cell phones, iPhones, videos, DVDs, computers,
TVs. Incredible amount of information they're being.
They see the world through a screen. So therefore, one of the biggest challenges they have that scares a lot of them is how to handle silence. They don't know what silence is. How to handle touching. A lot of them are starved for touching. And we're losing language. You know, we're getting close to the shadow side here. When we talk about all the pluses, I mean, these are the children that are going to take us back to the natural order. These are the children who know about spirituality almost from birth. These are the kids that start talking when they're 8 and 9 months old in full sentences. These are kids from the age of 4 and 5 years old to start up their own business, and usually by the time they're 9 or 10, they've paid for their college. These are kids that have their own website now. It's called www.bksk.com. In other words, by kids with 4 kids, bksk.com, that teaches kids about patenting and copyrights and spreadsheets and all these kind of things that they know, they need to know to run their businesses. I mean, these are just little kids. These are kids that can talk over the heads of their teachers and their parents and their neighbors and the whole family. These are kids that that require a whole different type of education.
Oh, which leads me to the question, Doctor. How is our educational system handling these kids?
Not well. 80% of the curriculum in all schools is geared toward the verbal learner. These kids, 80% of them, are visual spatial learners. So what's happening in school? We're losing these kids quicker than we can educate them. They're bored out of their tree.
No crap. Mm-hmm.
And because they think out of the box, they refuse to be regimentated into that style or institutionalized. So it's a real challenge.
These are quirky kids. These are quirky kids. They're different.
Yep.
Let me recommend a book here for educators. The book is called Upside Down Brilliance. Just remember that. It's about the visual spatial learner. And it's by Dr. Linda Silverman, like the metal silver, Linda Silverman. And she's an expert in working with gifted children. Most of these kids are gifted. And she really gets into details about how to educate these children in a way that they can learn. You know, if we get into the shadow side of these kids, they're highly sensitive to drugs and snack foods and processed foods and electromagnetic fields. Just highly sensitive to them. A lot of them have problems digesting their food, even organic foods. Their food needs for many of these kids is very different.
Why?
There's the fusion of sexes, gender mixing. They don't look at male, female genders like you and I do. There was a study done, I think it was about a year ago, and they estimated that 42% of these kids are bisexual. I can say that there is an increase in the birth of hermaphrodites, children now being born both sexes at the same time. These children are very at ease with lesbians and homosexuals and this idea that what's sex, you know, and that's no big deal.
Well, that's great.
And, you know, they look at sex very, very differently than most people do. They're very, very, very sensitive.
Do they look at it in a healthy fashion, Doctor?
Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Yeah, it's a two-sided coin, no doubt about it.
Yeah, you're talking a two-sided coin here. Because a lot of them regard oral sex as the same thing as kissing.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden you're hit with whoops.
Yeah.
Wait a minute here.
You know, I think that each generation is going to find a way. I mean, I think that that's something that's innately human. And, you know, I think the problems come in when you try to suppress it. I mean, that doesn't mean you let everybody go hog wild, but it's when we suppress it that
we
problem.
We need to educate these children.
Absolutely.
And we're not doing it. We seem to be afraid of the topic of sex.
Well,
and so,
yeah.
we really don't educate them properly.
Well, that's the schools and, you know, the schools.
And the mom and dad,
suck.
You know?
Yeah, and the mom and dad. But then there's also the religious sexual,
yeah, very right. much. They're religious, right. And in some religions, it's more serious than others.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah. Yeah. And these kids are super, super sensitive to trickster energy. You know what trickster energy is?
No. Nope.
That's your attachments, your possessions, your disincarnates, your,
okay. Material things, huh?
Invisible beings of various kinds, this type of energy. These kids are pulled into this type of energy super, super quick and have trouble with it. They're not good at it. So one of the things I hope that the listening audience pays attention to is that we really need a lot of good teachers and classes and schools on psychic self-defense, what psychic ability is, intuitive ability, spiritual ability. Let's teach these kids instead of just throwing them to the TV set and letting them learn all about Dungeons and Dragons instead of the real thing.
Go ahead.
These kids do not have any natural understanding of processing and time. In other words, they don't understand how long it takes to hone one's skills so that you're really, really good at what you're doing. They expect everything to be right away, and in most cases, they're able to do things right away.
Sounds like ADD or ADHD.
Well, I was just going to ask how many children out there have been misdiagnosed who may be part of these transitional kids and are labeled and are medicated to the point where they lose.
Well, most of them. You know, I was going to get into that in a moment.
Because they're easy to manage in the classroom then.
Well, the point I wanted to make here is that these kids don't understand patents and copyrights. Because you see, that takes time. They really don't understand getting degrees because that takes time. They expect all these things to happen quickly. Most of them do, and that's why so many of them have gotten in trouble with copyright infringement and patent infringement. That's why I think that website By Kids for Kids is so important. Let's teach them. Now you're jumping into learning disorders. And what the children claim is that they're not disordered, they're reordered. They're multi-channelers, and they really are. If you're going to look at the figures, 2 out of every 5 today in our country, United States of America, have a learning disorder. 1 out of every 10 are mentally ill. Over 7 million have ADD. Cases of ADHD are up 600%. Since about 1991, no long-term or autism spectrum is now considered so pervasive that it's called an epidemic. There has been no long-term study ever done on the effect of the drugs we give our children. Kids are medicated at the same rate as adults. The insurance industry gives incentives for drugs, disincentives for therapy. So parents are hitting this huge wall with these kids. Now, what we found in various places in Canada, for instance, if a parent goes to a therapist or a counselor with her supposedly ADD or ADHD or autistic kid or whatever, the first thing that counselor does is have an allergy test run and a food test run to see what is the child allergic to and how are they handling food. And by doing that, they have found that most of these learning disorders go back to allergies, specifically to foods. If they change the child's diet and do some therapy work on them, they are able to turn around these learning disabilities 80%. 80% turnaround to the positive. And if that doesn't say something to all of us, I don't know what will. I mean, that is a big, big one.
Yeah, and part of the problem is, you're absolutely correct, Doctor, part of the problem is they don't have the manpower to do it, nor do they have the time where they, you know, it would have to be so individually focused on those kids. One of the things that I see and that always concerns me, and I'm sure you're aware of, is the fact that many children that have superior intelligence often manifest symptoms that are very similar to ADD, and they
sure this is natural
on a maturity scale. They're very self-absorbed. They don't do well in school. They're dreamers. Those sort of things. And a lot of times, those kids are very, very misdiagnosed. They're standing in line getting their Adderall.
This is natural and normal for the new children. It has nothing to do with disorders. It has everything to do with the way we try to assembly line teach our children in schools.
Right. The schools are more concerned with spitting out widgets. They have become,
yeah,
especially with No Child Left Behind, you know, we're teaching kids how to take tests. And we're really losing the focus. And you know, it wasn't all that many light years ago that I went to school. And, you know, the teachers at that time actually took an interest in us.
Yeah.
And, you know, could color outside the lines a little bit. And nowadays, it's just the opposite. And so I've seen many frustrated teachers who, you know, I know that these kids are really bright, but they have to follow a format.
Yes, and I'll be glad when that format goes out the door.
Well, I'll have to knock on wood on that one. But, you know, it just seems tragic to think of so many gifted children, especially children that might have psychic abilities or abilities to actually...
They don't buy into it, but they do.
Yeah.
They do have these abilities.
To have them somehow, to have that suppressed, too, and not out of maybe necessarily out of malice, but out of misunderstanding, is really a tragedy.
Oh, it is. And, you know, some of the places across our world are catching on to this. Let me give you Perth, Australia. The schools in Perth, Australia have caught on to this, and they have made some sweeping changes in their schools that really didn't cost that much money. And what they did was they changed terminology. There is no such thing as classes. Now, today, they're called neighborhoods. There's no such thing as teachers. They're either mentors or guides. All of the walls within the classroom are movable so that they can change the structure of the class even daily, even several times a day if they want to. To control what was happening in the classroom. And let me tell you what was happening in the classroom. Today's children are so psychic, they can communicate mind to mind. Telepathy is commonplace. It is normal for these children to be telepathic. So what they're having in school, what was happening in school in Perth, Australia, and everywhere else, I might add, is that these kids are talking mind to mind with each other. And it's undermining the teacher's control. And, in fact, they were even talking classroom to classroom, mind to mind. And it was driving the teachers nuts. So what they did to combat this, and I think this is so clever, is that they allow the kids to talk quietly to each other, whisper, or just talk quietly to each other. They no longer require silence in the school, in the classroom. When they did that, the kids stopped communicating so much mind to mind. They seem to enjoy better just being able to chatter. Just doing these simple things turned around the classrooms, attendance, what the kids are doing, what they're remembering, what they're able to achieve, the kind of work they do, turned it around almost 90% to the positive, to the better. And that's all they did.
You know, the whole thing, it helps kids to think out of the box. And you know, I've never been a big proponent of keeping kids cooped up for 8 hours a day. You know, you let them out for 15 minutes for recess. They have way too much energy. That really stifles their creativity. But, you know, unfortunately, it goes back to, once again, they want to squeeze widgets out. They, you know, it's part of the institution, and I guess that's the first, you know, that's where you get to cut your teeth and learn, you know, to follow the rules and such. And so, you know, I hope we'll go that route like Australia did, because that seems to be the way to, you know, to stimulate and to encourage the potential in each kid, as opposed to trying to have
schools,
a herd mentality.
Yeah, some schools here are doing that. I talked to one teacher in New York City, and one of the schools in New York City, believe it or not, is switching to a format very similar to what they're using in Perth, Australia, and they have had just stunning success. So again, it doesn't take money, it takes creativity and cleverness and, like you said, thinking outside the box. Let's try something here. Let's do some experiments and see what really works with the children. And in those schools and with those teachers willing to do that, they're having remarkable successes, absolutely remarkable successes.
Well, here's a statement and a question.
Go ahead.
You know, light years ago when I was younger, that's a good comment, Grant. When I was in sixth grade, that was about 12 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Do you believe that?
We know better.
I wouldn't
don't
believe
fall.
That. Total error there. Anyway, you know, our whole school was open. There were no walls. And it was a brand new school. I went to it. It was the first year it was open. I was in sixth grade. That was in Denver, actually in Lakewood, Colorado, near your neck of the woods, Kristen. Kendrick Lakes Elementary School. I was just in Colorado a couple of months ago and went by it. Anyway, that's just the point. So, you know, there was a lot of their openness. And, of course, it was so long ago, I can't remember much about whether they made us stay quiet. But anyway, here's a question from the chat room. Kristen's saying 12 times 3.5. 12 years times, thanks, Kristen. It was 12 years ago. That's what I meant. Anyway, here's a question. Dr. Atwater, you had mentioned that there's been a real burst of these new children since 1982, correct?
Right. That's
okay.
True.
What, and the question is, what happened in 1982? What caused this? What do you think is responsible?
Computers. In 1982, specifically that year, it's when personal computers became available to the general public. We had had a building of energy up until then that was very much high-tech, that was very unusually creative and inventive. And I truly feel that it was all of this combined when we have this jump in genes to build a better brain. It's jumping in society. It's jumping in cultures worldwide. We have all kinds of genetic differences that are beginning to occur. We have all kinds of pushes where it comes to the mind, what we're doing, what we're achieving, changes in society, culture, structure. And it just, it burst through at the same time that computers were born, that is to say, for you and I in the general population, the personal computer.
So it was
and
a result.
There was that correlation of timing.
So is this a genetic component, or is it a phenomena that was instigated by the advent of computers on society?
Well, that and more. You know, Mother Nature.
You know what's really fascinating about this is the fact that, are you familiar with the term the singularity?
Well,
I'm not familiar with the gentleman.
For a black hole.
Not for a black hole. There's a gentleman that says a lot of scientists are thinking that we're coming to the point where this is going to be not our generation, the baby boomers, what I'm part of, but perhaps these folks that we're talking about tonight may be some of the first people that actually merge with the computer.
Well, I don't know that it's going to go that far, but it could. It could.
It almost, if it prepares one, if they were in some strange, almost ironic sort of sense, they're the first, they cut their teeth on it, and they may be the ones that eventually have chips in place.
Well, when we're talking about timing, and what I was starting to note was that Mother Nature always takes care of her own. And when something is needed in the human family in the way of genes, Mother Nature will supply it. And it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what we wish or what we want. It happens because the timing is right and the genes change, or there's some kind of genetic change, or blood type change that happens in the human family.
As well.
The environment changes, the stressors change, and of course that changes as well the organic compounds and makeup of our bodies, brains, and so forth. And what I want to insert in there is one of these timing glitches that caught us all by surprise. So I want to just sort of paint a picture and then give you the results. I'm going to take you back about 40,000 years ago. And what we know scientifically is about 40,000 years ago, humankind was faced with what is called a crash. That's what scientists call it, a crash or a crunch. That is to say, extinction of the human race because of weather, because of earthquakes, because of a lot of changes in the environment. The human race was faced with extinction. There was a gene mutation then that suddenly appeared in the human race that saved the human race. It just popped up. There is no record of that gene before 40,000 years ago. It jumped in the population at that time, then it went quiescent when it was not needed anymore. It jumped in the population again when there was a lot of die-off, a lot of wars, a lot of earth changes. Then it went quiescent again. But it never got to the point where 40,000 years ago, the original jump. Now it is getting close to that again. It is jumping so dramatically in the human species that it is breathtaking how this gene is coming back. And the main coding for this gene, it's not the only coding, but the main coding is DRD47R-ELELE. ELELE is E-L-L-E-L-E. Now that coding that's jumping, that literally saved the human race 40,000 years ago, you and I would not be here today if it weren't for this gene. None of us would be here today if it weren't for this gene. Do you know what this gene is that saved the human race?
Not a clue.
It is the same gene that we today call ADHD. There has been a 600% leap in just the United States since 1990-1991 in this gene appearing in our children in the United States. It is appearing all over the world. My question to everybody is, does Mother Nature know something we don't?
A thought, scary thought, huh?
Yeah, it is.
The only time this...
What evolutionary advantage did the gene provide to that population that allowed us to survive?
A lot of movement, you know, ADHD, movement, getting up, active,
years ago,
courageous, curious. Yeah, these kids are out the door.
Yeah, okay.
All right, let's explore that question a little bit more. We're going to take a break here in just a minute. And we appreciate our listeners and your questions, and there's a question or two in the chat room we'll get to after the break. When we do come back, we encourage you to continue the questions. Call in if you like. The number's there on your screen, 347-945-7799. We're talking with Dr. Atwater, and we shall be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org.
Is there a suppression of UFO and alien information by our government?
Does the soul continue on after we die?
Climb aboard the black ship of Paranormal Radio with your host, Captain Jack, on Contact Talk Radio and KRWM 106.9 FM HD3. Or visit WPRTRadio.com for more information.
Where will you find a professional association of paranormal researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena. And coming October 2008 to Tampa, Florida, the Paranexus Conference, a learning and networking event unlike any you've attended. Join us for 2 full days of innovative paranormal workshops. Participate in the Paranexus Challenge, where several teams will investigate a secret haunted location. Observe a live table-tipping seance at the stroke of midnight. Join us for the Spirits and Shadows Costume Ball. See old friends, meet new friends, win prizes, and have fun.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org.
And hello, everybody. We are back, Paranexus Universe, here with Grant, the Grant Man, a.k.a. Grant. Hey, Grant.
Hey, welcome, everybody. We're so lucky to have Dr. Atwater with us tonight.
Yeah, welcome back, Dr. Atwater.
Oh, it's fun to be here.
And we are talking about Beyond the Indigo Children, and we've talked about how there are a lot of names for them, including, well, you rattled off some Indigo Children, of course, and you said something about Crystals,
starseeds, cosmic transition, psychic. I mean, there's a lot of labels.
All right.
And if you toss all of those labels, just get rid of them, every one of them.
Okay.
And then take the descriptions that these labels were supposed to show. Take all these characteristics, all these traits of all these so-called labels, and bunch them together. You have the profile of the new children, and this is global. I call them new children because we've never had a generation like them before in all of history.
All right.
Very, very different. Today's children are no longer the people our educational system was designed to teach.
Well, hell, it was that way when I was in school.
Well, it's worse.
Yeah, apparently.
And the parents are even puzzled sometimes as to what to do with these kids. So I wrote the book, Beyond the Indigo Children, to define this and to talk about solutions. I'm a person that gives name, address, phone number. So if you want references, there's good references in that book. It's full of references. And then on my website is the addendum to the book that catches the book up to a lot of the latest in science and findings of various kinds.
It's
called Beyond the Indigo Children Extras. So you want the extras. It's on my website at www.pmhatwater.com. pmhatwater.com. It is a free download. It's about 30 to 40 pages.
Cool. There's a question from the chat room. Does Dr. Atwater think there's anything to what the conspiracy theorists feel that chemtrails are affecting us?
Well, that's off subject.
Well,
that has nothing to do with
relation,
these kids.
No, in relation to the kids. Is there any connection there?
That is still something that cannot be proved one way or another. We're still in the beginnings of recognizing that maybe there's something going on here. And maybe it's what we think it is, maybe it's not. It seems to affect some people, doesn't affect others. Seems to affect people in some parts of the countries, not at all in other parts of the countries.
But nothing.
For instance, where we live, we've got planes going over all the time, and I have yet to hear anybody talk about chemtrails. So it seems to depend on where you live.
Okay, and you had something that you wanted to discuss, something relating to shadow.
Well, I really want to get into high technology, computers, and all this kind of stuff.
Okay.
To take a deeper dip, if you will, into lots of broader topics. Because these new kids catch on so quickly, it's almost as if they invented whatever it is they're doing because they just automatically seem to know how to do it. And, and we were talking about how brilliant these kids are and how smart these kids are. And the latest research, though, is very disturbing. And when I say the latest, I mean it's fairly new, maybe in the last 6-8 months or so, a little bit longer than that, I think, but still fairly new research. And they've done a lot of research in schools now. And what they have found is that by the time the average child reaches puberty, so that's, between the ages of 10 and 13, or in some cases 9 and 13, about the age of puberty. 50% of them, that means half of them, have lost the ability to abstract. Now remember, abstracting is their greatest talent. It's their greatest gift. And by puberty, 50% of them have lost it.
Why?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What do you think is the culprit? What do you think would be the problem that these kids are running into that is actually what we're winding up with are intelligent idiots?
You want my opinion?
In other words, they're losing the ability to reason and think things through.
You want my opinion?
Sure.
All right.
Well, what do you think is the culprit?
I think schools are the culprit. I think that stupid... You know, I mean, there's certainly benefit to education. We all know that education's it, and we need to educate our children. We just need to educate them in a better way. And you know, I mean, it's no secret that our schools aren't honestly suck. You know, I mean, hell, they sucked when I was in school. I hated school. I detested school, and I still do. It's the worst thing any kid can go through, as far as I'm concerned. And so I think that's played a major part, but I think that there's also been some other dynamics. This is purely speculation, in my opinion, which I'm, you know, everybody's titled my opinion, right? Right? Okay.
Right.
Yep.
But
all right.
That's not the answer.
Well, I know.
That's part of it, but that's not the answer.
That's my
answer. The answer is a shocker.
Well, let me get to the rest of my answer. Maybe it's part of it. You never know.
Okay.
I also think that society and culture has played a part in it. And, you know, if we're talking about new children who have psychic abilities and all that, it's no secret either that a lot of these kids with psychic abilities that have manifested in younger years, you know, it's essentially been repressed and turned off as they grow
mm-hmm.
older. And so that, combined with cultural and religious issues, I think has done a lot to... disillusion a lot of kids. But you can go now and tell me what the real answer is.
Well, all of what you have said certainly plays a part in the conflicts we are having with these children, and we are having many conflicts. Fortunately, a lot of things are going well, but some things are not going well. But this big one that concerns me the most, the loss of the ability to abstract, to reason, to think things through by the time they reach puberty, 50% loss, I was not at all prepared for the culprit. And the culprit is virtual realities.
Hmm.
Any virtual reality. So we're talking cell phones, we're talking iPhones, we're talking Game Boys, we're talking video games, we're talking DVD, we're talking computers, we're talking television, we're talking any form or type of virtual reality. And what's happening, why this is such a fright, is because of the old adage, too much too soon. Virtual realities interferes with brain development. It directly interferes with brain development. The brain is so made that it develops and learns according to hands-on activity. It has to experience doing things. If all you're doing is watching it, or maybe running a little coordinator joystick, that does not enable the brain to think something through, to analyze it, to question it. It does not enable the body to experience all that it has to go through in the way of falling down a haystack or figuring out how to get out of a cave or so forth and so on. That we have to do these things physically. The brain is designed that we must do these things physically. So what is now being recommended is that no virtual reality of any kind until at least the age of two. So no exposure to television or computers or Game Boys or any of that stuff until the kid's 2 years old. When the child is 2 years old, from then on, you can do limited exposure, increasing it every year until they're about the age of puberty. And from then on, it doesn't have to bother so much in brain development as it does in the very early years. Now, what we're seeing, at least what I'm seeing here in the United States, is that by kindergarten, in most of the states I'm familiar with, especially in North Carolina, they are teaching kids in kindergarten how to use computers. Now, that's directly interfering with brain development. And we're doing it as a matter of course in kindergarten. Disney Studios has come out with a television channel for toddlers and babies, training them and teaching them over this television channel when they're just toddlers and babies, in defiance of recommendations from people who know what they're talking about. It is it's just a huge, massive problem. And it's getting bigger and bigger and more serious. What we're losing in all of this, in addition to what I've already said, is that with too much reliance on computers and chat rooms and game boards and so forth and so on, it's distracting the brain, even in older people, or I should say older kids. It's distracting them to the point that we are now losing as a society, as the human species, the ability to language, the ability to think deeply, the ability to concentrate. And what employers are finding with these new kids when they're, you know, when they're teens and in their 20s, yes, you know, they're very optimistic. They value diversity. They're civic-minded. Yes, they're multitaskers. Yes, they like to be recognized for achievement. Yes, they communicate well electronically. But they require supervision and structure almost all the time. They have short attention spans. They lack patience. They're not able to think for themselves. And if you look at the globe, if you look at countries, if you look at politics, if you look at history and the march of history, where are we marching toward if we're destroying our children's greatest talent by too much too soon? This, to me, is the most serious problem we have to face, and it's a particular problem most people have no idea even exists.
What? Here's a question from the chat room. Any these video games that involve killing, do they have any effect on these kids?
Oh, sure. Sure. Absolutely. If we're going to look at content, not just the electronics themselves, but if we're going to look at content, yes, that matters. Now, believe it or not, the actual physics or the actual wiring of the electronics and the pulsations actually is the worst culprit. Not content, interestingly enough. But interestingly, but content does come in. Here's another little scientific finding. Children as young as 12 months will emulate behavior they see on television. Now that's 12 months old. That's a year old baby that is now starting to emulate behavior they see on television. And another thing they found that just rocked my socks is that if any home, doesn't matter who it is, whether it's rich people, poor people, doesn't matter, where they have television as background sound, the child will play less and do less and talk less. In other words, you can't even have the computer on as background noise because that also robs the child of the desire to talk, the desire to do things, the curiosity to explore, even of social behavior. So these wonderful things, and they are wonderful, that can enrich our lives and do, if we use them too much, or we use them without thinking, or if we overuse them with children, society itself is now in the process of paying a terrible price, and they will continue to pay more and more of a price. Now, what interests me here is that most things, not everything, but most things that are dangerous or pull down or weaken or lessen our abilities can be overturned later if we take steps to overturn them. And one of the things I really recommend with children who are watching television or who are using computers, get those kids pets and have them be responsible, completely responsible for that pet. Get that kid outdoors where they're raising something. Even if they're in an apartment, they can have a windowsill where they're raising something, some kind of plant, some kind of herb, some kind of flower. Get those kids making cookies or some kind of something, the consistency of cookie dough, where you're not using cookie cutters. The child has to, in their own hands, mold the shapes themselves. With fruits and vegetables that you serve, have the child cut them out and make creations or beings out of those fruits and veggies. There is a book out called Play With Your Food. It is recommended in my book, Beyond the Indigo Children, that teaches kids how to do this and parents to help the child be more creative. You know, these are simple things that have great impact in how they affect children. Get your kids making things and field trips as much as you can. Field trips don't have to cost anything or very little. When your child has a question, either look it up in the dictionary, maybe you might look it up on the computer, Wikipedia or what have you, but get your kid out the door to where they're actually doing it, or where they visit that site, or where they talk to those kinds of people, or where they're out in the sunshine doing things. It makes a tremendous difference.
But hasn't this always been the case? I mean, just letting kids do their thing in many ways, you know what I mean? I mean, yes, they need guidance, they need direction, they need education, but, you know, letting them play. I mean, Grant mentioned earlier about recess being so short and, you know, you're in prison, in school. You know, there needs to be more play time because that play time is...
It's crucial.
Yeah, it encourages creativity. And it also encourages social skills and letting them work on some of those social skills, working out.
But it's actually part of brain development.
Mm-hmm.
It actually leads or controls or directs the structure, the actual structure and function of the human brain. So, yes, this has always been true, but now it's more crucial than ever before because we have more technology. We're teaching kids at very young ages how to use it. This is good in some ways, not so good in others. If we limit their use and, you know, just have them use it a little bit more, you know, year after year, then by the time they're in their late teens, early 20s, they're in a lot better shape. Their brains are in a lot better shape. They're able to think better and concentrate more, and that makes such a difference. You know, just as kind of like a brief aside, this is science, scientific finding dated April of this year. And they've discovered, let's see if I can actually read it to you. Your brain can only make one decision at a time. If you're using email and phone calls both at the same time, in other words, you're multitasking, tasking or juggling, or excuse me, it's called toggling in the brain. If you do too much of that, they can register a 10-point fall in their IQ, which is over twice the impact of smoking a joint of marijuana.
Hmm.
So too much multitasking, too much toggling of different tasks and ideas, the brain literally begins to lose its ability for intelligence, to lose cue, to lose its versatility.
Hmm. Interesting. I'm just looking at over some of the questions in the chat, if they're making sure I don't miss any of these things. One comment here is, I guess, comment. Knowledge is power. Might that at least partially explain the widely held belief that they are wise beyond their years? Kids are incredibly sophisticated.
Well, I think that's some of it, but I really think the big one is the ability to abstract. Because these kids come up with these incredible observations that are not based on wisdom. They're based on the ability to abstract. And we get that mixed up sometimes. We think, oh, gee, what a wise child, when the real talent is their ability to see beyond the view.
Well, you know, one of the things that kind of troubles me about it, and I think that you shared this concern or kind of alluded to it, is the fact when, you know, when they go to employment, like you talked about, Doctor, they need, you know, they're enthusiastic, everything else, but they need constant monitoring to be able to follow through on stuff. And you know,
and they quit
I'm
jobs
not so
easy.
Sure. I'm
they
not
don't
so sure.
Stick.
I'm just
they don't
wondering
stick.
In my mind. In my mind, I'm wondering how they're going to integrate themselves into society in terms of being able to you know, make a living.
Yeah, and what's going to happen with society?
Yeah, well, hopefully that'll be a positive change for society. I think that we need to move away from the mentality that we have, you know, where work is drudgery, and maybe hopefully these kids. But unfortunately, with the economy, you know, an employer's not going to hold on to somebody that they see as a liability. You know, and somebody like that, if, you know, and the whole thing is to make money, whether they're working at Blockbuster or whether they're working at
But what are you going to do as an employer if most of the people that you would want to hire are like this? If
probably
the majority of people are like this, where are you going to find anybody else not like this?
You'll probably see a whole flock of seniors, baby boomers, taking the jobs that they don't want.
Well, we're starting to see that right now. You're starting to see more and more older people in fast food restaurants because the kids don't like it.
Yeah, well, they won't do it, and, you know, they know that it's a dead-end job.
Right.
And you know, it's really something. I'm hoping that all these wonderful creative kids will be able to take that energy and everything else to help us solve a lot of these problems. And maybe that's where the strength is going to be. Maybe that's some sort of, you know, like I said before, it's a next step in our evolution.
They have the creativity. They have the knowledge. They have the ability. Absolutely, hands down. This is the brilliant, most innovative vision we've ever all of history. But goes with that. What would you call it? I hate to use problems. I'll use challenges.
Yep.
A lot of
very.
And I really think the solution here is mentorship. This idea of the adult taking enough time, maybe even a bit of time to mentor them or teach them or lead them or guide them. That's all they need. Got the stuff. We have to teach them how to dive. They already caught it. We need to teach them, aid them in right usage.
And a comment.
In a sense, they're teaching us, but the bottom line is that we're the ones that are standing still. They're the ones that are moving forward, and maybe they're going to be the catalyst for that change that has to come.
Oh, sure. I mean, these are the kids that are going to save the world. They're going to change society if they don't jump off a cliff first.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah, and by far, they're the most knowledgeable kids that have really benefited from the having all the fingertips of the knowledge at their fingertips. I mean, when we grew up, you know, we had to go to the library if you wanted to read books and things like that. And now all you have to do is if you can come up with anything, if you want to know where Constantinople is, you can pull it up on Google.
But, you know, if we're willing to pay those few extra dollars for gas, it might be better to take them to the library.
Absolutely.
Google them. Because they need to get out the door. They need those social skills. They need to know what a library is. They need to walk up those marble steps into this big hall. They need that exposure. Remember, these kids are viewing the world through a screen.
Yeah,
that's not healthy.
Yeah, and you're right, and we have to help them step out of it. That's got to be our role, too, to take that and to help that to be the to facilitate that process.
Our role is not that big. These kids could literally educate and raise themselves. They're that smart. our role is to expose them and lead them and guide them and challenge them. And if we're willing to do that, we're going to just have remarkable children. Well, we already do. They're just going to get even more so.
So how's this generation, how is it different than previous generations, like our generation, my generation, yours, the ones before that? I mean, is there...
Well, I relate to these kids as if I were one of them, and I think I am. So I'm almost 71. So,
how do the previous generations, you know, relate to or compare to this? Because some of the things that you're talking about, you know, I'm looking back on my childhood and being challenged and allowed to develop and all that stuff. You know, those were also important then, although, of course, there wasn't computers and all that sort of thing back then. But, you know.
Well, remember, this profile of characteristics has been around for a long time. We're just now seeing more of them. In fact, we're seeing so much more that it's almost as if most of the children throughout the world are now like this. So it used to be there were some of us. Now there's lots of us.
Interesting.
You know, and if you're going to look at prophecies and ancient prophecies, and if you're going to go even further with brain development, then all kinds of fascinating doors begin to open up. If you just go the way of brain development, what we're seeing now is the prefrontal lobes in the brain are now beginning to flower as never before. That's the highest development that we've ever had in the brain. It's almost as if a transcendent development in the brain. The prefrontal lobes are called the wings of the brain because this is the seat of judgment, morals, empathy, compassion, and well-being. The prefrontal lobes represent the highest and best in the human family. And we're seeing more and more and more and more and more prefrontal lobe development. And all it takes for that kind of development is the perception of safety. If the mother, while she's carrying the child in her womb, feels relatively safe and at peace in her environment, then the brain automatically develops toward prefrontal lobe development. It automatically begins to turn on those particular triggers in development that enable that kind of flowering of the brain to occur. However, if the mother is frightened, if she's worried, if she's overly stressed, if she does not feel safe, then the brain automatically begins to develop in the lower aspects of the brain called the reptilian mind or the survival mind. And that then begins to develop. The reptilian instead of the higher, more spiritual prefrontals. And it's just the perception of safety. And it happens automatically while the mother is carrying her child. And then after she's given birth, then up to the age of 3, that is also a very, very crucial time for, you know, is it going to be the reptilian brain and survival, the idea of survival of the fittest, or is it going to be the prefrontal lobes, the idea, of the highest and best in the human family?
We call it objects relations. And, you know, it's one of those things where you're absolutely correct, Doctor. And it's the infant's reaction to tension. Whether it's in vitro or whether it's on the outside. And, you know, object relations is a very fascinating, you know, study in psychology. And you know, it really makes a lot of sense. If an organism is subject to tension, whether it's, you know, one of Harlow's monkeys or whether it's a human being, they're going to react to that.
Well, you know, and in recognizing that, I think we also need to recognize that over half of the population in all of the Arabic countries are under the age of 25.
Hmm.
They're the new kids. Now, in most of these countries, there's a lot of tension, a lot of stress, maybe even war. You know, it's like we're creating the new jihadists right now with these little kids and what they're exposed to. In all countries except Iran. And I find this the most fascinating of all, if you're going to look at prefrontal lobe development. And that is in Iran, the Islamic Revolution in Iran was in 1979. And at that time, after they overthrew the Shah and all this kind of stuff, they made it an incentive throughout the country for women to have babies. Have as many babies as you possibly can. We're going to give you money. We're going to provide this. We're going to provide that. They would do everything for these women to have as many babies as they could. This incentive program went on until 1990, and then it was stopped. So for that 11-year period of time, the children born in Iran were loved, they were wanted, they were well cared for, they lived a life for the most part like people in that country had never lived before. These children were very well cared for. Now, today, what we're finding is that that age group, so we're talking late teens, early 20s, that age group in Iran, especially in their 20s, so they've now reached adult age or nearly so. These children exhibit all of the attributes of prefrontal lobe development. These are the children who are against the Khomeinis. These are the children who are fighting with the clerics. These are the children who want Iran to couple with or join with or become friendlier to the West. They're not at all satisfied with their current politics and the way their country is run. I truly feel that what could make the biggest difference in that part of our world in another 10 years is going to be Iran and the young people in Iran who have developed these prefrontal lobes. I think this is just absolutely exciting, what can and is now happening in that country.
Well, you know, the other side of that coin is, and I don't want to sound negative, is it really makes you weep for the Iraqi children.
Well, yeah.
Who may have been possessed these abilities, and think of them, all of them, that are suffering through the consequences of our shock and awe campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, as a solution, for most people, for most of these kids, there is a solution. And that solution is attention and love and education and caring. If they get enough of it before they are, if you'll excuse the expression, a hardened adult, we can bring them out of this.
Can you expand a little bit or reiterate what you had said about the prefrontal lobe?
Well, they're the wings of the brain. They are about the area of the temples and going on back. You can just take the open hand, your open hand, and just put it over the temples, the temporal lobes, and just go on back with your hand as if you were making wings. And that's where they're located. But also the prefrontal lobes, you know, take the heel of your hand and begin about the middle of your forehead and just, you know, let the open hand go back. And that's the prefrontal lobe area.
And what's
that's the seat of all of our executive functioning, making decisions, emotions, It's where all the higher functions of the brain are located at.
And it also represents the highest and best in the human family if it it fully develops and fully blooms. Because not only do you have judgment there and morals, but you have empathy, compassion, and well-being.
Yes,
so you've got
absolutely.
The higher spiritual qualities are just naturally part of the prefrontal lobes. That's their function.
Well, and of course, Doug and the audience, if you're not aware of it, hence the title, prefrontal lobotomies. That's
yeah.
what used to go with folks during the 40s, and they would completely sever parts of the prefrontal lobe, and it was remarkable. I've seen people, experienced people, and actually interact with them that have had lobotomies, and the results were pretty widespread. Some people did survive, some didn't, but once that had been set in motion, those folks, their behavior was pretty much in concrete after that.
Yeah, you know, it's like they're not human anymore.
Right.
Or they seem to lose the best in the human qualities.
Yeah.
And so the Iranian, this new Iranian generation has this prefrontal lobe development?
In my opinion, they do. We don't get a lot of statistics and a lot of reporting that comes out of Iran, as you know, because of all of the, censoring. But what we have had really shows that these kids do have advanced prefrontal lobe development. They do not agree with the politics there. They want to be more Western. They're more spiritually inclined. They're more empathic. They're more compassionate. They're a completely different type of Iranian than their parents and their grandparents and those before them. And they really defy what the clerics want to come out of this country.
And that would apply.
Well, they're going to reject the fundamentalism. That's what they're rejecting. Or that
they're absolutely rejecting it.
They're rejecting it because it's too restrictive. And I think, by and large, I think the folks that didn't come through the Iranian Revolution, the same folks that held us hostage, like Ahmadinejad back in 1980, those folks are kind of aging now. And the younger folks, they've also not only benefited from the type of nurturing and child-rearing that they experienced, but also these kids have access to the same computers and the screens that our kids do over here.
Well, they're the new kids.
Yep.
They're literally the new kids, and they have not
global
been
phenomenon.
Held down like a lot. Yeah,
yeah.
These are fantastic kids. No, I really look forward to learning more about how these Iranians develop, and I think they're going to change that country. In fact, I know they are. But if we look at prophecy, if we go back to esoteric traditions and ancient calendars and a lot of our indigenous people and their various prophecies about the coming times, most of them, not all of them, but most of them talked about the coming of the fifth world. And when the fifth world rises, with the rising of the fifth world will come a new race of people or a new kind of people. Some of the esoteric traditions go even further than that, and they talk about the root races, a root race, root meaning foundational. So they're talking about the gene pool. They're not talking about a blue race or an indigo race or a yellow race. They're talking about a different type of genetic structure, a different gene structure. So we're talking foundational gene pool here. And they're talking about the fifth root race. Now, according to a lot of esoteric tradition, there is a plan, a great plan, supposedly by God or whoever that great mind is, whether you want to call that mind God, Allah, or the One, or the Force, or whatever you want to call it, That supposedly there is a plan for the development of life on Earth, but specifically for the development of consciousness and how consciousness moves and changes on Earth. And if you want a good taste of that, then you want to study the Mayan calendar. The Mayan calendar is not a calendar as we know calendars. The Mayan calendar is a device to make track the development of consciousness on the Earth plane. That's it. You don't have it any other job. Now, it can be used in some way to talk about events or what might be happening, i.e. a type of calendar. But jobs is not as a calendar per se, just track consciousness. So when you're looking at the Mayan calendar and you're looking at how it measures the coming of suns, a sun, S-U-N, the sun or suns, they use that term to describe worlds. So the Mayan calendar is set up to track five worlds, the coming of five worlds or five suns. And now this timing is the timing of the rising of the fifth sun. Now, there aren't too many people out there who talk about the Mayan calendar that I will listen to, because a lot of them, I don't think, use good research, really work with the elders, the Mayan elders, and really make an attempt to truly find out what the Mayan calendar really is. There's a couple of them I will listen to, like Don Carlos Barrios, a Mayan elder. He's one of the few I'll listen to. Calaman. I also have a great deal of respect for him. And there's a few others out there that I think really know what they're talking about, and the rest of them know. They either have exaggerations or they're tripping off on their own dreams or their own psychic impressions or whatever else, and they're moving away from what really exists as the Mayan calendar. So if you look at the calendar itself, it ends with the rising of the fifth sun, and that supposedly happens December 21st, 2012, or if you go into the other interpretation, it's October 27, 2011 or something like that. Anyway, it's in October, maybe October 11 of 2011. Anyway, it's October of 2011. So it depends upon what interpretation you read.
So what's your, 2012?
Yeah, if you just get into the symbology and the tradition and the traditional understandings of this, then you begin to realize that, well, yes, interestingly enough, the human race did change in a very significant way, evolution-wise, during each of these worlds or suns, and that's exactly what we're moving into now. With the rising of the fifth world, we've got the rising of the fifth root race. Now, in esoteric tradition, it tells us that as each wave or sun or world deepens and intensifies, its vibrational frequency accelerates and genius flowers. Each root race changes the body type of the found in the human family. Each root race spreads and further develops a certain chakra, its corresponding chakra in the human body. Each root race has its own Noah, its own Adam, and its own Messiah. So we're looking at large, expansive, evolutionary changes in the human family, which can be tracked not just through the Mayan calendar, but through the Vedic Yugas and many other, the Iroquois Nation and many other calendars and prophecies. So when I'm looking at the changes that are now happening in the human family and what I can track, it matches what we can know about the fifth root race. Supposedly there are a total of 7 of them. So we would be at number 5. The fifth root race, as it accelerates and expands. So it's not just beginning, it's actually accelerating and expanding. It's been around for a while, but it's now jumping. Or, you know, that big quantum leap that we were talking about earlier. And the body type that has been predicted is what we've been talking about. So we've got a lot of matching here in what's going on as compared with the traditional esoteric view, the mystical view, also the Ebola or ancient view. What would be it about this time? And book, Beyond the Children, this in depth, going to great, the march of the generations and their various types of energy signatures. I mean, it's a deep book in many ways, book in lots of other ways. There's a lot in there. But I do some speculation about the fifth root race. For each root race, Noah, its own Maya. Who will be the Noah for our current body type and genetic structure of our people? Who will be our new Noah? And I believe that it is Nelson Mandela. And the reason I say Nelson Mandela, remember, Noah was the one who, according to biblical stories, saved humankind, that rescued humankind, enabled humankind and animals and birds and so forth with Noah's Ark, enabled it to continue in the world. So who's going to enable the human race this time to continue in the world? And I truly feel it's Nelson Mandela. And the reason is Nelson Mandela taught the world what true forgiveness and reconciliation is. And without that knowledge and ability to forgive and to reconcile, this world is not going to go anywhere, and our human race is going to go downhill.
Okay, so let's talk about your website. We've just got a little bit of short time here left.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's okay. You're doing fine. Tell people where your website, your books, how they can get them.
Okay, my website, www.P as in Paul, M as in Mary, H as in Howard. So it's PMH at water. You know, just regular spelling, pmhatwater.com. You can get my books at any bookstore. They should be able to order them for you. You can get them off amazon.com. I have a bookshop in my website. We're talking about the book Beyond the Indigo Children. We're talking about the new children and near-death experiences. Lots of other books as well, all of them solidly research-based, but also page-turners. I do not write dull books, nor am I a dull speaker.
Well, that's an understatement. All right. Well, listen, we really appreciate your time tonight. Thanks for coming back on again and talking about this interesting topic. Taking your time, and I'll give you a chance. We really appreciate it, Dr. Atwater.
Well, thank you. It's been fun for me, and I hope it's been fun for all the listeners.
And speaking of listeners, we really appreciate everybody taking their time to tune in to Paranexus Universe as well.
Join us next Wednesday, or excuse me, next Thursday night, same bat day, bat time, bat channel, and all that stuff. We're going to be talking with Patrick Burke. We're going to be talking about Civil War Battlefield Ghosts with Patrick Burke. So join us next week for that. Wanted to encourage folks who haven't to take a look at Paranexus.org. We have our conference coming up here this October in Tampa, Florida. We have readjusted the conference to a three-day. It'll be a Friday, Saturday, Sunday morning. But the best news is that the conference registration fee we've been able to drop down to $99. So it includes the whole conference. It would be a great time to come and join us, to have some fun, to network, and to learn, enhance your abilities as far as paranormal research is concerned. So hopefully you can join us. We'll look forward to that. We appreciate, again, you taking time. Grant, you have a great night.
Thank you, Doug.
And I would like to also thank the Skype gods tonight. They were very kind to us, so we appreciate that. Everybody,
Doug, I'm back. Thank you, and I want to also say thank you to Dr. Atwater very much for coming on the show tonight. It was a pleasure.
Well, my pleasure, too. Thank you.
All right, everybody. You have a good night. See you again next week.
Bye-bye, all.
Sky. It's Paranexus Universe.